onto reflexes. So, what are reflexes? Well, your textbook says that reflexes are not a behavior. Reflexes are an interaction between a stimulus and a response. Yada, yada, yada. Basically, reflexes are a stereotypic movement pattern or a stereotypic physiological response. There are some endocrine reactions and whatnot that would be reflexive as well. But basically, there's something that occurs very stereotypically. There's a stimulus and there's an outcome response. That's your reflex. Now, one of the interesting things with reflexes is they're generally fairly stimulus-specific. Particular stimuli will produce particular reflex responses. And they have survival benefit. They don't occur just for any old random reason. These were something that were selected for because they assisted the organism in actually living. So we might say most reflexes are produced due to natural selection processes, that they are evolved. Give an example. Grasping in infants. If anyone's had a chance to try this with an infant, you'd probably be severely chastised nowadays or possibly arrested. So just do it, you know, when child welfare services aren't around. For a soft surface and not with your own kid. Infants have this incredibly strong grip strength. And, you know, you get their little finger, you know, if their fingers wrapped around your finger, or if you have long hair, your hair or something, it can be very, very difficult to get them unattached. Now, if we take a look at other non-human primates, this makes a certain amount of sense. You say, why does a human infant need that kind of grip strength? It doesn't really. It's a carryover, right? If you take a look at non-human primates, the way they carry their offspring around is just by having the offspring grip onto mom or dad's fur, right? That's it. That's the carry system. We've had to come up with, like, you know, snuggle pads and carry slings and all kinds of other stuff. But ancestrally, we were a lot furrier. Well, okay, actually, my cousin, but most of us are less furry than we used to be. So that's what the infants do. And if you ever watch, you know, shows or actually get to see, you know, go someplace where there actually are monkeys or down to the zoo or something like that, you'll see that the infants, Calgary's got a nice collection of primates. So if you go down to the Calgary Zoo, you can see this. Check out the cotton-topped tamarin enclosure. You'll see that the infants are just clutching on to mom or dad and being carried around that way. But it does mean that, you know, you can do stuff like this in this picture where you give the kid a pin, let them wrap the little fingers around it, and, hey, hoist them off the bed. Yeah, which is yet cool and both terrifying at the same time. Another reflex, eye blink, okay? You can do this at home, kids. Get a air delivery system, which is fancy science speak for a straw. Okay, go by A&W, swipe a straw. Get a participant subject, a friend, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend, somebody you know, whatever, to sit there looking straight at you. Take the air delivery system and blow in their eye. Don't spit. That's just yicky, okay? Nice, dry puff of air, boom, they will close their eyelid. For a much more expensive way of doing this, you could sneak into an optometrist's office and get a hold of the glaucoma detecting device, which is this monstrously horrible torture device depicted here. I have an aversion to these things. Actually, it's a conditioned aversion, as it turns out, but we'll talk about that in classical conditioning later. What this basically does is the optometrist, lines this up with your face. You have to put your chin in a cup and your head in a headband, and you have to look straight ahead at the little light, and then they blast you with a puff of air in your eye. The whole point is to see whether or not your eyeball is squishy. If it's not squishy enough, that's bad. If it's too squishy, that's bad too, but you probably don't have glaucoma. So, what happens, though, is the air puff goes Ah. Have none of you ever done this? Yeah, a few people have. Okay, three of you, and the rest of you are just hoping that your eyes aren't going to rot and fall out of your head because you don't go to see your eye doctor. Don't really people do. Okay, fine. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's what's happened. That's the reflexive eye blink. On my point, I've had this done so many times that I developed a conditioned response so that now whenever I sort of like just get into the machine, my eyes are doing this crazy. It's like, you have to open your eyes. Like, yeah. Yeah, okay. So, closes. Okay, that's a reflexive response, right? It's a reflex action. Puff of air hits the eyelid. You know, the eyelashes detect that, connected to neurons. Neurons connected to the brain. Brain goes, hey, close the eye. Okay. Limb retraction. Classic, if anyone's ever read Descartes or seen an intro psych textbook, the classic picture of, you know, person reaching for fire. Why exactly? He's like, I'm going to reach my hand for fire. Pull it back. But classic Descartesian depiction of reflex is a limb retraction. This could be because you've touched something hot. Could be because you've, if it's a foot, you've been walking down the beach or something, and you stepped on something sharp. You end up in Karate Kid pose. Any number of things. So a limb retraction. It's a very, very fast muscular contraction. It pulls the hand, the foot, whatever, away from whatever sharp, pokey, hot, damaging stimulus is. So it pulls the whole limb back. If it's a particularly intense stimulus, you don't just go, ooh, with the hand. You're like, blah, or flailing your whole limb back. Okay? So there's degrees of how strong the reflexive response is going to be. But in any case, all these reflexes are generally quite rapid. Right? I mean, imagine if the limb retraction was slow. So let's say you've stepped on a piece of broken glass on the beach, and you're stepping down on it, and the glass is now puncturing your foot and going through. You go, uh-oh, yeah, I think there's a problem there. Oh, yeah, that's glass poking through. I should pull that back. Oh, boy, that's going to take some disinfectant. At which point, some sea lion comes by in your lane and eats you. Okay? It's like, oh, food, right? Okay, they don't actually eat people, but, you know, you'd think maybe they would try after we've been hunting them for a very long time. So being slow doesn't work. Reflexes are, they're hella fast, okay? They're really quick. Now, the reason that they can be so quick is your brain's not really even all that involved in them, okay? You don't have to think about them. There's not a lot of cognition going on here. Maybe you've experienced this. You've like touched something really hot on the stove. You didn't think the burner was on or whatever it was. Boom, your hand's back. And then a second or two later, it's like, ow. No? Okay. Well, at least one person knows about this. Yeah, sure. Homework. Okay? Homework. Get a really hot pot in the stove. No. Okay. But, yeah, you may not feel the pain or be going, ow, or jumping around or whatever. Until a few seconds later, but ooh, your hand's already back. If you had to work, if this had to go through the cognition, if your brain had to process everything, it's like smelling something like bacon. What the? No, my hand's on fire. What should I do? Down through the computer, sort of scrolling. You know, imagine you're a Terminator. Possible outcomes: pull hand back. Possible outcome: smash hand on stove. Possible outcome: shoot stove. You know, it's like okay. Yeah, by that point, your hand is just crispy. Right? Or you've ended up like the Nazi in like Indiana Jones and like the Ark thing is imprinted on your palm. Okay. That's what we call in science bad. All right? So very, very quick. Doesn't really involve cognition. These are really simple neural pathways. Okay, and when you look at things like worms, they have reflexive responses too. They don't really have much in the way of a brain. So it doesn't really take a brain to do reflexive responses. Turns out the brain's not necessary. All you need really... Well, effectively, really only two, but in most cases, three neurons, called a sensory neuron, an interneuron, and a motor neuron. Here's how this works. It produces what's called a reflex arc. Okay, so sensory neuron in blue, interneuron in green, and motor neuron in red. Now, if, and that little sort of oval thing there is a muscle, let's say that we... this is going to be a system in our, let's say, our arm, our limb retraction. Okay, so the sensory neuron is coming from detecting sensations, let's say heat, down from the fingers, sensory neuron, up the arm, into the spinal cord. So it comes into the spinal cord. Interneurons in the spinal cord there. Interneuron connects up to the motor neuron. Motor neuron goes back out of the spinal cord into the muscles of your arm. Okay? So we present some sort of painful stimulus there, heat or a pinprick or something, to the sensory neuron. Signal is now going to, through the wonder of the neuron system, signal goes down the axons, gets sent back to the muscle, and hey, our muscle has just contracted, gotten shorter, pulls the limb back. Okay? So that's a reflex arc. Now, effectively, as you hopefully remember from your intro class, or other courses, or you know, high school, or Wikipedia, or just plain life, I don't know. Signals transmitting down an axon are really, really fast. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they're pretty much instantaneous over the distances we're dealing with. Where things slow down, and it's not a big slowdown, but it's still a measurable slowdown, is when they have to go through a synapse. So when one neuron connects up with another, then it shifts from electrical propagation into chemical propagation. Neurotransmitters are released. They drift across the synaptic cleft. They get picked up by receptors on the other side, turn back into an electrical signal, back down the next axon. With only a couple of synaptic connections here from sensory to inter to motor, there's very little slowdown. This is an extremely fast neural response, okay? Which means it happens really, really quick. Which means hopefully you haven't gotten too damaged in the process. Now, good question. What's going on with this one over here? What's this connection marked by the question mark heading off to? Well, in things like invertebrates, anything with a spinal cord and a brain, and actually in invertebrates that actually have like some of the insects or higher invertebrates that do actually have neural ganglia, let's call them brains. What's happening there is the interneuron is not just completing this little reflex arc, it's also sending a signal off to the brain. Okay? And so that one, let's just say it's in us, that one goes then up the spinal cord into the brain and then goes through any number of additional synaptic connections. Every time you go through a synaptic connection, the signal slows down a little bit. Okay? So that's why you touch something hot, phew, your hand comes back, and then a second or so later, it's like, ah, my hand hurts. Or if you're me and you curse and swear a lot, you say something else, and my kids go, oh, you write that down to use that later, you know, sort of thing. But Dad says it. Yes, okay, right. We'll talk more about trying to condition that out of people later in the course. But the reason that's slower, the reason the response or the understanding of what happened is slower is because you may have to go through 15, 20 synaptic connections in the brain before it gets down to making a vocalization. Brain's got to process that. What just happened? What should I do? I should probably say something. What should I say? Search. I should say ow. Okay, good. Signals then have to get sent down to the cranial nerves, down to the work the muscles and the jaw and the tongue, and ow, comes out. That's slow. All right? The reflex is already done. Over and done with. It's happened. So, reflex arc. At minimum, here, three neurons involved. Yeah? Sorry, if you what? Yeah, what if you're trying to inhibit a reflex? This is the thing. So, for example, you may have to. It's like, oh, the pan's on fire on the stove. You know, ceiling about to catch on fire. Yeah, you can force yourself to pick something hot up and move it. But your brain, you've made the cognitive decision. You've overridden your reflex of fire bad, run, into pick this up. And, oh, hurt. So, yeah. And you're probably not, you know, people say, instinctively leapt in towards the danger. No, actually not. You can be trained, conditioned, and in fact, military, police, or whatnot, are go through a conditioning process to get them to like run towards guns instead of away from them, that kind of stuff. But Yeah, that requires a cognitive processing in there. So there is conditioning involved, but there's new. It's not an innate process. So picking up the hot thing on the stove and moving it such that something worse doesn't happen, that's not going to be a reflex. You have to actually override the don't want to be near this, must do this because otherwise my house is going to burn down or something like that. Those are very interesting. Those are very interesting ones. Okay, so reflexes. I'm going to shift in a little bit here and go from talking about a response, a movement of a part of an organism, to talking about behaviors that involve the movement of the entire organism. Now, these are called tropisms. It's actually a rather old word here. You don't necessarily hear a lot outside of the biological sciences, but tropisms mean the movement or change in orientation or direction of the entire animal. A lot of the early scientific study of tropisms goes back to a guy called Jacques Loeb, who I think was very clever, very smart man, if for no other reason that he decided to work principally with marine invertebrates, lots of invertebrates, but he liked working with marine invertebrates, things like anemones. That's an anemone. Okay. And why I think this was brilliant was because this meant that he had to make frequent research trips to the beach, which is not stupid. Where are you going, Jacques? Oh, it's my research, Dean. I've got to go get rent a cabin on the ocean and study anemones. It's like, oh, well, all right. What do we got here in Alberta? Cows? I mean, yeah. It's like, where are you going? Yeah, I'm going out to a field to study cows. It sucks. I think there's a reason so many people decide they want to do cetacean research, animal research and psychology. It's like, I'm going to go study dolphins. Why? Because you think, because they have to move to Hawaii. So what do you think? I'm not stupid. I said, yeah. I was. I studied water striders. Yeah. Up to my waist in ponds with dead beavers here in Alberta. Yeah, okay. Anyways, so Jacques Loeb, very, very clever. If you have to pick a research animal to work with, if you decide to go on, be it in biological sciences, psychology, whatnot, pick something that lives somewhere warm. Drinks with little umbrellas in them. Okay, so anemones become well known from Finding Nemo, right? Where we start out living in an anemone there. Picture of a much less colorful anemone. So Loeb would do this. One of the things Loeb studied early on is what we call geotropism. Okay, geo meaning geology, earth, tropism, orientation. So anemones will orient themselves with respect to the substrate, the bottom of a tide pool. Okay. How was that? Seriously?
There is a fire alarm in CSIS 2. It is all clear. It is safe to enter the building.
Oh, yes.
CSIS 2, you are allowed to enter the building. It's all clear.
Starbucks is on fire.
I feel so much better about our safety down here because... Well, excellent then. Good. So we've all come back in after dutifully leaving the building. Geotropism. Right. Movement of the entire organism with respect to not burning up and dying horribly. Okay. Anyhow. So, yeah. Okay. Anemones. If you ever have to make a sock puppet for a kid or something to entertain a kid, make an anemone. Easiest toy to make ever. Take two socks. Take one sock, stuff it down into the toe of the first sock. Take a pair of scissors. Cut down the opening from the leg into you got a whole bunch of little strips dangling down. That's your anemone. Look, kid, made you a toy. Ah, your toy sucks. It's an anemone. Ah. Yeah. Put the sock on your nose. You're an elephant. Yeah. Okay. But that's basically it. right? I mean, they're basically a sack with some tentacles waving around there, mouth in the middle. They grab a little thing, stuff it in their mouth. That's it. So, ideally, they're in the tide pool there in the ocean, and their tentacles are up in the water, and their foot is down on the sediment. And that way they're, I mean, as happy as something without a brain can actually be. They've got a distributed neural network, nervous system there. But, I mean, you know, happy is as happy does. They're able to eat this way, okay? They can grab things floating around, eat it. Good. So, Jacques Loeb comes around, goes, hello, anemone, grabs it. It's like the, you know, 160-pound bully to the anemones, picks them up and stuffs them upside down until their tentacles are down in the dirt. This is less than ideal for the anemone because it can't eat. So very slowly, they don't move very quickly, so very slowly over the next 10 or 15 minutes, they flip themselves over, put their foot back in contact with the substrate, and pull themselves back upright. So they have gravity detectors. Okay, they've got little things inside their body that will move depending which way they're oriented with respect to gravity, and they can tell. Right, they don't have any real cognition. It's not like you're thinking about this. This is all very, very innate. It's just hardwired into their nervous system. Okay, this does not involve any learning whatsoever. But it's a tropism. It's a movement of the entire organism here with respect to some stimulus. In this case, gravity. Well, gravity sucks, okay, as we all know. So gravity's pulling down on it, so the anemone has to reorient with respect to that stimulus. There are there's lots of different types of tropism. So anybody fish? Fishing people, yeah, okay. So I mean, you know, if you're fly fishing, you want to cast upstream so that your fly will come back down with the stream, because the fish will orient into the current, so that like bugs or things that fall onto the water just come. It's like a conveyor belt smorgasbord for a trout, and you know, so swim around. It's like one of those old computer games, like you just have a grab the fly as it comes by and eat it sort of thing. So that's called streamotropism. I can't remember. It's got some Latin word for it, for orienting with respect to the current, or heliotropism, orienting with respect to the sun or another light. Okay, so basically these are tropisms. Lots of different things. It can be tropism in response to heat, moisture, all kinds of stuff. Now, within tropisms, there are two categories here. First is kinesis. This is movement that is random with respect to a stimulus. So basically, if a stimulus is detected, this causes the organism to move, but the organism doesn't actually have the ability to sense the direction, the orientation. It's not moving with respect to the stimulus. The stimulus just starts the movement pattern. I'll give you an example in a minute. Taxis is non-random. That is, it is directed either away from or towards. Okay, so kinesis might be a critter's chemoreceptors detect molecular traces of food in the area, and this causes it to start doing a search pattern. But it's not directional. It just wanders all over the place until it just happens randomly to stumble upon the food and then can eat it. In taxis, this would be more like, anyone watch Godzilla movies? Godzilla, right? There's all these crazy old monsters like Mothra, giant space moth, loosely based on Earth moths, except really, really big and from space. And apparently hating Tokyo. So, like, moths have antennae, right? Antenna there, right? And the actual earth moths use these antennae for a variety of reasons, but for example, following a pheromone trail of a female moth. Okay, so, you know, if the left antenna is picking up the pheromone trail, it turns to the left, and if they're both getting about an equal amount of the pheromone, off it goes. Same thing happens with Mothra in space, you know. It's right antenna. It's like, Earth is that way, and Tokyo, which I must destroy. I don't know why. It just does. And so it's like, oh, I send Tokyo. Of course, flying through space is stupid because it has wings and they don't really work in a vacuum, but that's not really the point. It's probably got anti-gravitational something. It's a Godzilla movie. It doesn't really matter, okay? Well, the point is Mothra can home in on Tokyo. That would be a taxis. Okay, that would be a directed movement. Okay. So, kinesis, movement in a random direction. Here's a little depiction, okay? So let's give you a representation here of a study that can be done. We get a, we'll use the scientific term, a testing arena. Could be a plastic box or a cardboard box, but you know, you don't want to write, "I used a cardboard box" in your scientific journal article. So we call things like testing arenas. It sounds more, you know, science-y. Cylindrical landmark could be a beer bottle. No, I'm not kidding, seriously. Done stuff like that in the past. But you don't want to just say, well, we've used any old thing we had lying around the lab, and we had lying around our lab was a whole bunch of beer bottles. So, yeah, the pigeons got to, use cylindrical landmarks. Anyways, so testing arena could just be a Tupperware container here. Okay, heat source, like light, would work nicely for this one. So we shine the heat source on one end of our, it's now turned on, on one end of our testing arena, making this corner hot and the other corner cool, or at least cooler, and somewhere we've got a temperature gradient here. Now you can notice a lot of invertebrates, like bugs, okay, for lack of a better word here. So take a little bug, plop it in the middle there, and off it goes. Now, many bugs will desiccate really quickly. They lose moisture really fast. So if it's too hot, they can just burn up. That's like flies on windowsills. It's like they die there because they eventually desiccated. So you should, if you love nature, you should always take and put a little sponge with water on your windowsill to keep the flies alive. Okay, now notice what's happening here. Our little thingy here is, it's if the closer it gets to the hot zone, the faster it seems to move. But notice it's actually wandered closer to the hot zone for a while there. So this would be kinesis. It's not actually sensing the direction of the heat. All it's doing is, so it takes a step or a movement or makes like five steps or whatever, and then goes, how hot is it here? And if it's hot, it's going to randomly pick another direction to go and scurry off for a little bit and then go, how hot is it here? Now, the hotter it is for many of these invertebrate critters, the faster it will sort of run. It'll motor along. The cooler it becomes, the slower it'll move until eventually, hey, think back to control systems, right? Our actual input has dropped below our reference input and it goes, well, okay, stop. Right, so at that point, just stops sort of running along there. But if we moved the heat lamp over or something, suddenly the actual input starts to go above the reference, and it's like start moving again. The hotter it goes, the faster it goes. And this, I mentioned I work with water striders for my PhD, so I spent a lot of time watching bugs do stuff. They're not very bright, which meant sometimes you just had to sit there and watch them for a really long time, much like this. Off it goes that way. It's like, you're going the wrong way! Don't really care. It is going slower, though, now that it's gotten down into towards the cooler side. And where it's going to end up ultimately just sort of is this kind of random thing. Much slower. Please be done. Can't remember if this is the... Might be one. Yeah, okay, there we go. So, yeah. So in the middle there, it's sort of moving at a medium-type speed. It slowed down over on the right, moving quite fast, over on the left, quite slow. Okay, so very simple. So with kinesis, you could have, in this particular example here, a very, very simple sort of control system where if the temperature is close to, you know, maybe just a little bit above the reference input, move around, you know, at a slow speed, the higher, the further above reference it goes, the faster you move. And just hopefully, given time, you randomly get into an area that's cooler or moister or it has more food or whatnot before you die. Let's contrast this with taxis. Okay, so movement that bears some actual relationship to the location of stimulus of interest. So testing arena again. Here we'll have the heat source, and we'll use another little critter there. In this case here, it's made a turn. And, yeah, this is going a lot faster as it basically heads towards the cool corner. So this one's got some sort of sensors, heat detectors that allow it to determine which way is hot and which way isn't, and it just heads off in that direction. Now, I haven't actually shown you like schematic data from real insects there. What I've done is produced a couple of very, very simple models based in part upon years of working with insects. This is really kind of stuff you'd get. But we're going to talk, you know, about models throughout this course as we go. So I thought I'd introduce you to a model right here. You too could do this kind of setup yourself. All I did here for the models was put some very simple components into the design. So for the kinesis, I said there'll be a random turn. So I let it turn, you know, one of eight compass directions there. So it's a little random number generator that would do that. I had a set movement length, so it would always move the same distance. And I just set it so that it would never turn more than 180 degrees. Okay. The only thing that was really different here in this was the movement speed. If it was like on the right side, it would move fast, so it would be a very short time before it hopped to the next random location. On the left side, it would move slowly. Okay. And then I just ran the model, and that's what I got. But it looks stunningly like the movement pattern of something like a woodlouse, an actual little arthropod. Okay, so that's a nice example of kinesis. Now, part of the reason why I did it this way is to show you that these are the only elements involved in the model. That's it, and the model gives a movement pattern, like I said, very similar to an actual organism, a woodlouse. Now, what this means, a woodlouse has like maybe 100,000 neurons, 90,000 neurons, something like that, okay? Doesn't take, but the behavior pattern, right? I mean, if we went back here and looked at the behavior pattern, this looks like a pretty complicated walk pattern, right? It's a complicated, there's something interesting going on there. But really, this could be very, very little neuronally, very, very simple neural mechanisms, which make it look like you've got a very complex behavior. Right. Now, for the taxis example, just said, okay, we'll set it such that the model will turn, so it moves away from the heat. Again, a set movement length, it'll always step the same distance, won't make any more than a 180-degree turn, and in this case, the movement speed is fixed. But setting that parameter, putting those parameters in place, bam, I get the little model producing, again, something that looks essentially identical to actual biological organisms. So this kind of modeling is very very interesting. You can get some very complex, what seems like, you might say, the second one there, the taxis, that critter knew that if it stayed close to the heat, it was going to burn up and die. No, it doesn't have to know anything. That can just be neural connections. You can get complex behavior without any real cognition. So these become very interesting things. And sometimes some very tricky things for behavioral scientists to work through when dealing with their subjects. Right? How much cognition is actually at play here? Sometimes maybe a lot, sometimes maybe very little. Do we have a learned system, or is this an innate behavior pattern? All right. So, kinesis and taxis. I'm going to shift here now. I'm going to move on to talking about, like I said, I prefer the earlier term, fixed action patterns, but your textbook author, Dr. Chance, has adopted a more recent rebranding, if you will, of the term into what's called modal action patterns. I don't care. You can use either. They mean exactly the same thing. If you go back into the early 20th century, they were called, researchers called them fixed action patterns because they thought they were very fixed, that they would never, ever, ever change. That's not quite true. There is sometimes some variation in them, but not a lot. Fixed action patterns are very species specific. So the kinds of behavior that one species has is going to be different from that of another species. They're often also very state-dependent. They may depend upon the time of year. So, for example, I'll come back to them in just a moment. They also require, and again, older terminology here, you may encounter this, it's called a sign stimulus. The textbook calls it a releaser or a releasing stimulus, but originally a sign stimulus. And so the fixed action pattern is activated by a particular stimulus, the sign stimulus. Other stimuli aren't going to do it. Okay, and it seems to activate what's called a dedicated neural system. It's a part of the nervous system that does this particular pattern of behavior. The final thing here is that a fixed action pattern, once initiated, so once begun by the presentation of the sign stimulus, will go from start to finish, no matter how ridiculous, ludicrous, or irrelevant it happens to be. So, turkeys, the noble turkey. Benjamin Franklin actually wanted the wild turkey to be the American national bird, but he lost out. The eagle instead. Bald eagle got that one. So, yep. Anyhow, the turkey, gobble gobble, that kind of turkey. That's what I'm talking about here. Mating. Okay. For everything else you can say about a turkey, male turkeys at least pick their female mates, Not exactly about because of their mind, but at least we can say because of their head. So, Thanksgiving or Christmas comes around. A lot of people eat turkey. What's left over? Well, there's some feet and wings and stuff, but there's also a lot of leftover turkey heads. So, get yourself a female turkey head. Put it on a stick. Put the stick in the ground. Get yourself a male turkey. Male turkey sees the female turkey head, starts doing his male turkey mating dance. Ever seen a male turkey? They're great. I mean, they strut around, they gobble, they put their chest out. Okay, they do this sort of thing. Now, if you had a live female turkey, not a head on a stick, right? And the males only do this during mating season. Right. Other times they're not just wandering around doing mating dances all the time. So seasonal specific, okay, activates a particular behavioral response, the courtship dance, courtship ritual, okay. And the sign stimulus here is kind of specific. If you had an actual live female turkey, if she was interested in the male's dance, she would say, "Oh, you're looking good, you're dancing well, but show me more," right? She'd stick around. If she wasn't interested in mating, she'd just like wander off. And the male would like kind of, you know, meant to do that. Wasn't interested anyways. You're lost, baby. That sort of thing. Now, head on stick in the ground. Male's strutting his stuff, right? Well, not exactly staying alive because she's dead. But look, she hasn't gone anywhere, right? She must be really into him because she hasn't run off, because she's a head on a stick. Dances some more. She still hasn't left. He's dancing closer to her. And eventually he tries to mate with her and keeps kind of tipping over because there's no female turkey there to actually mount. But eventually he thinks he's finished up and wanders off. It's like, yeah, it was good for me. Hope it was good for you. Insane? No, fixed action pattern, right? I mean, look at it this way. In nature, in the real world, where is a male turkey going to encounter a female's head on a stick? Right? You gotta be some sort of sick, twisted psychologist to go, "I got a female turkey head and I got a stick. What can I do for my PhD? Oh, I know! Turkey puppy, turkey puppy, turkey puppy. Hey, let's screw with the male, see what happens." Well, that's cool. Dissertation, right? Okay, I mean, in the real world, female's either going to leave or she's still interested in him and she's going to be there. So, okay, fixed action pattern. The head is the sign stimulus, right? In the real world, if there's a head, there's the rest of the turkey there, okay? Right? It's not like Mr. Fox has killed the female and is like messing with the male. Ooh, you're very attractive. Come closer to me so I can eat you too. It's a fantastic Mr. Fox kind of thing. Okay, so species specific. Turkeys do this. I mean, you know, humans don't. It's probably good because that's kind of gross. So species specific, state dependent, particular season, mating season, sign stimulus, turkey head, okay, activates this dedicated neural system, goes to completion. Here's one that's maybe not quite as funny, but the gray-lag goose. So they nest. They have an egg in the nest. Sometimes eggs roll out of the nest. This kind of thing happens. And what they'll do is they'll just reach out with their neck and kind of pull the egg back in, bring it back in until it's in the nest and mom sits on it again. Okay. So the sign stimulus here is a displaced egg. It's rolled down a little bit. Now you can do this. You can set up a little apparatus that will. Little sort of beep lever thing that, you know, by remote control, you can beep, pop the egg so it rolls a little ways away. Very experimental, okay? And so then the goose will pull the egg back in. All right, here's... Then what you can do is you can reach out and pull the egg, you know, as she's pulling it back, you know, take it away from her and see what happens. Now, this should work. This is like really old footage from, I think, the 50s. But that's what she's doing. Now look, he's taking it, and she just keeps doing the pulling motion. Okay, here, we'll do it again. Okay, so he's taking it away. She keeps pulling her head all the way back. Instead of like chasing his hands, like, hey, that's my egg. Okay, so that's what she's going to do until she gets it back to her. And now he grabs it, and she keeps doing the head movement. Okay. Fixed action pattern. The sign stimulus is the displaced egg. The response is use the underside of your beak to pull this back to you. And she keeps doing it even if the person's reached out, grabbed the egg, and taken it away. She has to complete it. Fixed action patterns will go from start to finish. And here's some guy with a gun. Oh, right, they're shooting gray-lag geese. Okay, I see how that one came up. Oh, YouTube, you clever little thing. Stickleback. Okay, charming little fish. We have them here in Alberta, pretty much all over the world. They're called stickleback because they have these spiny dorsal fins, which you grab them. Oh, fish stuck in hand. Okay. Males. Males, during mating season, their belly and underside of their mouth and whatnot turns red. This doesn't happen with females. Females stay blue or brown or whatever color they happen to be, the different species of stickleback. Males hold a territory. They find a part of the pond, or you can do this in an aquarium. In fact, an ethologist called Tinbergen did this way back in the 1940s, 1950s. You can keep them. They're beloved by biologists because these things keep really easily in fish tanks. Very easy to keep. Interesting behaviors. Nifty courtship dances. If you're interested in things like aggression, beautiful demonstration of aggressions. Males will fight with other males over territory because the male that has the best territory and the biggest territory is most likely to get a female who wants to mate with him. Right? So, I mean, if a male's got a crappy little territory, the female's just going, oh, your territory sucks. It's like, you know, having it's like, you know, a pinto car or something and, you know, a pony or something, you know, a really crappy car or a bad apartment. Cell phone, that kind of stuff. Yeah. The ladies, they will not find you attractive unless you have the latest electronic gadgets. That's how men think, right? It goes with cars as well. Okay. It's called evolutionary psychology. I can explain that to you guys later. But there was actually a study. Generally, males like things that are bigger, right? Because it's more expensive and more powerful and whatnot. There was a nifty study 7 or 8 years ago where they looked at cell phones. And so they found that men would, like, going into a coffee shop, would, like, put their cell phone on the table. And if another guy came in and sat down in the coffee shop and put an even smaller, that is, more expensive cell phone on the table, the first male would very often kind of take the cell phone, put it away, and get up and leave. Because he was being out-teched by somebody else. Clearly the other male had more wealth and resources to spend on even smaller cell phones. This is a few years ago. You may not remember how big cell phones used to be. Like that. Anyways, okay. Stickleback. So the males will defend the territory. If another male comes into their territory, they will attack it. They will do a very stereotypic, aggressive interaction. Now, the question is, what is it that causes the males to attack? Well, Tenbergen made a series of little models out of wood, sort of fishing lure type things, and they really don't look anything at all like an actual stickleback, but he's painted the underside red and the top white or gray, sort of pale. Turns out this thing, if he tied any of these onto a bit of fishing line, pulled them through the male's territory, he'd attack it, okay? Just goes nuts. Beats the crap out of the little lure. Now, if he doesn't paint the underside red, the male doesn't attack it. Now, as I said, females do not have a red underbelly during mating season. Only the males do. So if something comes in, something vaguely fish size, it seems, initially, well, that becomes an interesting question. Does it have to be fish size? See that, in fact, it does not. But if something comes into the territory, into the area that's got red on it, attack it. In fact, if you take a female stickleback and you dye her underside red, let her swim over to the male to check out his territory, he will attack it. He will attack the female. She's like, whoa, 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 I'm not into the rough stuff. Swims off, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, you better run. He's like, dude, that was a girl. Couldn't have been. She was red. Red throat. No. Yeah. Okay. So, here's the story. Okay. Tenbergen was up in Sweden doing this work. Had his fish tank of stickleback in the window just get natural light. Every day around about 2 o'clock, all of the male stickleback in the tank would leave their territories, start banging their noses into the glass looking out the window. Sometimes a little bit before 2, sometimes a little bit after 2. Okay. Then they go back to their territories, a little loopy, but going back. Next day, same story deal. The heck's going on? Turns out, around about 2 o'clock, sometimes a little before, sometimes a little after, the red mail truck. I couldn't find a Swedish mail truck from like the 1940s, so this is like, you know, a Royal Mail from a cartoon for kids, sort of thing. But red mail trucks. They had red mail trucks. So the mail truck pulls up outside of the biology department. The fish can see it through the window. And it's like, holy smokes, there's a really big male over there. He's coming to take my... Oh, I'm going to... Yeah, and they just keep banging their nose into the glass until it, you know, the mail delivery is done and the truck drives off. And it's like, I win. I don't feel so good. Just going to go back in territory. Red, okay? So in this case, the sign stimulus that elicits the aggressive behavior in the male is the color red. Okay. Now, I'm just going to mention briefly here what are called supernormal stimuli. Now, it may be that the mail truck got such a strong response here because it was really big, okay? Not, you know, tiny. I mean, stickleback are like this big sort of thing, right? So the little red patch on them is like, you know, tip of my finger sort of thing there, right? You got this big red mail truck outside the window, and it's like, oh, it's a giant male fish. Activates an even stronger response. So this could be the size. It could be the color. Maybe if it was even a brighter red or something, this would have produced a stronger effect. Okay, so you get these stronger responses. Now, up to a point, this could be really beneficial. So consider, let's consider a gray lag goose, right? So let's say mom's got 2 eggs in the nest, one a little bit bigger, one bigger than the other one. Generally, the larger the egg, the healthier the chick is going to be. It's got more stored nutrients inside. It's going to be the healthier offspring. So if your 2 eggs roll away, which should you try to save first? The bigger one. Why? Because that's probably the highest value, the most likely to survive chick. Okay, if you can, go back and get the second one next. Maybe there's time, or maybe a fox runs by and eats it, but save your best egg. Okay? So in some cases, this works. So going for the supernormal, the larger, makes sense. But in some cases, this can actually be detrimental. So I'll give you a kind of a... I'm using a little example of this. which I call Beatles on the Bottle. This comes from a paper from 1983. Gwynn and Rentz looked at male jewel beetles. These are in Australia. Okay, charming little beetles. Nothing problematic with. Well, they're not actually that little. They're about yay big, so reasonable sized beetle there. What they found was they were getting some weird stuff happening. As the beer bottles in the 70s and 80s here in Australia have these little sort of bumps on them. It might be a little bit hard to see, but they have little patterned bands there. And this was sort of before a lot of the don't litter public service announcements were being done. And so, you know, people just like throw the beer bottle. The implication is that Australians will drink a lot while they drive back in the 80s, which... probably not wrong, but you get all these beer bottles littered on the side of the highway. And what they frequently find, the biologists, Gwynn and Rentz, is these male beetles hanging out on the bottles, basically trying to mate with the bottles. Okay? What the heck is going on? Well, it turns out that the color of the beer bottle, so the light hitting the beer bottle, and because of these little bumps on, the reflection of the bumps, acts as a supernormal stimulus. So if you have a female jewel bottle, they're called jewel beetles because they've got these bumps, the sun hits them and it reflects in a pretty way and they look shiny and jewely. Okay, and this is how males pick the best females. So again, the larger females likely have more eggs. The more eggs the female has, the more likely you're going to get more offspring out of it. That's the female you should try to mate with. And so, you know, you've got these females along the sides of the highway going, hello, I'm over here. Hello. And you've got these males that have this weird fetish for a beer bottle. Yeah. So they go off and try to mate with a beer bottle instead. Not very successful. Once the beer bottle designs change, they stop having little bumps on it, didn't reflect the light quite the same way. The males are done with their essentially, that's kind of like inflatable dolls, I suppose, in a way. Isn't it? Except for a beetle. So beer bottle. Anyways, so not always useful. I mean, up to a point, the female with more jewels on her is going to get more male attention, except this case she's being outcompeted by a logger. All right. So, fixed action patterns there. There is another category of behaviors that are called very broadly general behavior traits. General behavior traits are very strongly influenced by genes. So they've got a very strong innate predisposition to them, but they're not quite the same thing as a modal action pattern. They're a little bit different in that they are somewhat more plastic. So a fixed action pattern or modal action pattern really has to go from start to finish. Okay, once initiated by the sign stimulus or releasing stimulus, blah 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 blah, blah off it goes. General behavior traits don't have a single eliciting sign stimulus. They will respond to a number of stimuli, and the particular response could be different depending upon various circumstances. However, there are some very species-specific kind of patterns that you can see. So let's consider, for example, what are called species-specific defense reactions, or SSDRs. You've probably heard of the fight or flight, but really there's sort of three of them: freeze, fight, or flee. Okay, so the three Fs here. Let's consider the differences between some species: a mouse versus a bear. Okay, so something threatening shows up, whatever it could be. You startle a mouse. What's the mouse likely to do? Well, depending on the distance, and this is an interesting one here as well. So let's say a mouse is walking along and it spots a cat. Now, if the cat is maybe a few meters away, maybe four or so meters away, what it might do is flee, turn around, run off. Now, cats are motion predators. If things move, they will orient to it and leap on and attack it, try to grab it. Okay. If anyone's ever played with a cat with a feather or a piece of string, you'll get this. If the string's just lying there, not moving, the cat's kind of like, twitches, you know, little paw lashes out and grabs the string. Okay, so they respond to movement. So if the mouse is maybe, you know, 3-4 meters away, might flee. If it's like maybe within a meter or so of the cat, like cat comes around a corner, it's probably going to freeze. Now, if it's not moving, the cat just may not notice it. it might, but as you know, if it runs off, if it turns to run, cat can probably get to it before it can run far enough. All right, so it might freeze in place. If somehow, you know, cat's walking along this side of a house, the mouse is walking on this side, and they bonk nose to nose, well, freezing isn't going to do much. You don't see me. Running's not going to do much, so you might as well fight. It's probably not going to help you, but, you know, you bite the cat in a sensitive place on its nose, and maybe it goes, meow, and in the time that it's going, my nose, the mouse takes off. So, species-specific defense reactions. Let's consider a bear. So, you know, the bear sees something startling a few meters away, it probably goes, rrr. The bear sees something startling, like, really close to it, it probably goes, rrr. The bear sees something startling, like, right around the corner and bumps into it, it just goes, rrr. Yeah, if you're the bear, if you're, like, the top of your, you know, food chain, there's very little you really have to be worried about. There's, you know, bears will run away from some stuff, but they're more predisposed to respond to things aggressively. Why? Because they can. There's not a lot that's really going to hurt them until you get rifles. Well, unless you're a black bear and you encounter a grizzly bear. I mean, grizzly bears just rip black bears apart. So if you're a grizzly bear, right, there's not a lot that's going to, well, except maybe a polar bear. Okay, but I mean, a polar bear's not going to be around a grizzly. Well, this one's Kodiak. Okay, my point is, if you're a large bear, you're probably about the most dangerous thing in the woods, unless, of course, you're a gruffalo. Anyone know the gruffalo story? Don't you know Gruffalo? Anyway, it's a kid's story. Okay, but you get the idea. Species-specific defense reactions. Now, they're somewhat plastic, right? What the mouse is going to do here may depend on some situation based on, like, distance to the predator. Okay? But it's much more likely that a mouse is going to do something non-aggressive in response to danger than a bear will. Okay? So, general behavior traits. There's a genetic influence to them. There's been selective pressures, naturally selective pressures on the species, but they're not as specific as a fixed action pattern. And in fact, these can be modified by learning. So, right, if, you know, if the cat that's in the yard is like, you know, Mittens, you know, a 13-year-old blind in one eye, no claws cat, right, that's just kind of like hanging out on the porch enjoying the sun, right, I mean, the mice just might run right over Mittens after a while if, you know, if they get used to Mittens. It's like, I don't know. The cat just, like, picks me up and gums me a little bit. Nothing really bad ever happens with this one. You don't have to worry about that one too much, okay? So, you know, in fact, the general behavior traits can be modified by learning in this case. Okay. So they're not strictly environment or genetically controlled. Instead, conditioning. Now, one of the with respects to, well, humans or even non-humans, the way that sometimes general behavior traits get studied is by looking at twin studies. And these get kind of interesting because, with respect to understanding behaviors, because, of course, you've got identical and fraternal twins. So identical twins genetically are the same. Okay, so you've got the same genome in the identical twins, but different environment. You know, once they're born, things may be more or less similar. So you can get cases where you've got identical twins reared together, identical twins reared apart. So you can play around with this. At that point, you can see how different environmental influences can come into play here. Fraternal twins just happen to be born at the same time, but genetically they're no more similar than any other siblings. But they have a more similar environment than, say, siblings born, you know, years apart. You can do this with non-humans as well. There's all kinds of fun things you can do now with things like mice in terms of producing cloned offspring, so essentially inducing identical. Well, you don't even have to do twins in mice. You can, like, get a whole litter of genetically identical little mice pups and then play around with the environment. So these get to be very interesting ways of testing the role, the effect of the genes on general behavior traits. And other types of behaviors as well. Okay. There's other things we can do as well to look at the role of genetics, that is, these sort of more innate systems, on behavior patterns. Selective breeding studies, for example. So these are longitudinal studies where over a number of generations you breed non-human animal subjects for particular characteristics, particular traits. If you're doing this in a laboratory, you're generally engaging in artificial selection. That is, the researchers are picking the characteristics. If you're using wild populations, for example, say, there are, what is it, 9 different strains of chickadees in North America, something like that, and but they're separated geographically by mountain ranges or things like that, distance. But genetically, they're quite similar, but they have different things in terms of song. They'll sing different types of songs, and so like a West Coast British Columbia male chickadee is not going to impress chickadees from Georgia, southern U.S. with his song, because there's differences there. So you can look at, in that case, you've got a natural selection process. Genetically, they could interbreed, but there's been differences in the kinds of communication they do over the years, and so we can look at how well those behaviors translate. So there's things there. So we can look at either artificial or natural selection populations. You can do stuff like morphine addiction in rats. So you take some rats, first generation of rats, you give a certain amount of morphine to, and you put them on, say, like a hot plate or a shock pad, and you say, right, I'm going to breed a really morphine-resistant rats. And so you got your rats, you find those, you've given them X amount of morphine, and you take the ones that still show the most pain, and you breed those together. Next generation, do the same thing again, give them also morphine, see which ones still show seem to show the most pain by making the biggest jump or startle response or something like that. Breed those together. And you can do it the other way as well. You could take the other ones that show the least pain and breed them together. And then over generations, you're going to get differences. You're going to get some rats for whom morphine has pretty much almost no effect, and others for which, even a tiny little bit of morphine is like, wow, just plastered. Morphine's an interesting drug to look at with stuff. It blocks pain, and it does sometimes some funny things to cognition, which is intriguing. But we'll come back to things like morphine later on. We'll talk about this when we get into classical conditioning, and we'll talk about the issues in terms of drug addiction and overdoses with respect to things like morphine. One of the longest running longitudinal studies in terms of selective breeding was done by a Russian geneticist that got in the 1950s sent to Siberia because Stalin didn't like him, basically. Believ was his name, and he ends up in Siberia with not much to do, but they're farming silver foxes for silver fox coats, basically for the fur up in Siberia. And some of the fox farmers, like, you're Believ, the geneticist, right? And it's like, who wants to know? Because if you're Stalin's secret police, then no, I'm not. And it's like, no, we're silver fox farmers. Like, you're a geneticist. We farm silver foxes, but, the problem with them is they keep biting us. It's like, well, you're planning on killing them for their furs, so I guess, that's probably fair. So it's like, yeah, whatever. Can you make, like, a fox that's not going to bite us as much and be as aggressive? It's like, I don't know, nothing else going on in Siberia, really. So, sure, see what I can do. So he starts doing this, starts breeding. And what they do is basically they breed the least aggressive of the foxes. Here's a little clip here. Some of the clip's a little kind of pokey, but you'll get the idea.
A remarkable experiment in Siberia may hold the key to understanding how wolves turned into dogs. Well, 50 years ago, Soviet scientists set up a breeding program to try and domesticate silver foxes. Here, on a farm outside the city of Novosibirsk, the experiment still continues today, overseen by Dr. Ludmila Trut. The breeding program began in 1959, when the first foxes were selected from local fur farms.
We approached the animals in the cages and recorded their reaction to us. We could see that some of the foxes showed aggressive behavior. Others were frightened. But only 1% of them showed neither signs of fear or aggression.
Okay, so variation in the population, talked about this earlier with evolution systems. So they got variation. Only about 1% don't show any fear. Now, out in the wild, they'd probably be the ones going, well, hello, what are you? Will you play with me? And it gets eaten by something, right? So kept at a pretty low level, right, by other predators. So, but they're working with that here.
The radical changes came through in the 8th generation when foxes started to show affection to them. The amazing thing was that calves who had just started to grow opened their eyes and started showing affection to humans by breathing heavily, wagging their tails, and howling. This kind of response was a big surprise chance.
Half a century on, the 50th generation of foxes are tamer than ever. It's an accelerated model of how dogs might have been domesticated from wolves. But it's not just the fox's behavior that has changed. Just a few generations into the experiment, scientists began to notice a curious phenomenon. The normal pattern and silver color of the coat changed dramatically in some of the tame foxes. Their tails often became curly instead of straight. Some young foxes kept their floppy ears for much longer than usual, and their limbs and tails generally became shorter than their wild counterparts. In effect, tame silver foxes were beginning to look more like dogs.
What this shows is that when you select integration, you get almost all the same suite of changes that you see when you compare dogs to wolves. I think the surprise when thinking about dog origins is that there's so many ways that dogs are different from wolves. So is it that you had to select for each of these traits individually? Well, the answer from the fox work is no. If you just select for behavior, a lot of the morphological and physiological changes that we see between wolves and dogs, they just get dragged along.
Yeah, so what is actually happening there is cortical steroids. By selecting for lower aggression, selecting for lower cortical steroid levels, and this goes through a breakdown process. Cortical steroids go through an interesting biochemical breakdown process, which has effects during development on all kinds of other things, like even pigment migration in the embryo. So the coloration pattern changes. It slows down the movement of the pigment cells through the embryo, so you start getting spotted foxes. And from the point of view of trying to make a tame silver fox for the fur industry, this was a dismal failure, because after about 10 generations, you're getting foxes that no longer have the silver color pattern, which no one really wants to buy. It's like, wow, great, you've got a dog coat. That's weird. So this didn't work for that. But by that point, Belyev and the other scientists who are working on this are going, this is like really interesting, and start publishing on it, and at least within Russia, got himself a little bit out of disgrace with the Stalin regime, and they start putting some funding in. What's happened kind of tragically on this was after the breakdown of the Soviet Union, funding got yanked for all kinds of scientific program. So by the 60s, they were actually getting some funding, and this expanded enormously. And then by the 21st century, funding is pretty much entirely pulled. So you get a sense of this a little bit from some of these pictures, but there was like acres and acres and acres of kennels there. There's very little left. This is very almost a ghost town of a research place. And the tragedy here is this is like really the longest running controlled artificial selection study that's been done. So from a genetics point of view, behavioral geneticist point of view, this is a gold mine. But they're having a very hard time keeping it going. So about eight years ago, they started trying to sell silver foxes, the domesticated silver foxes, as pets to try to make a bit of money. I don't know that you can get them in North America, but certainly at least in Eastern Europe, and I think parts of Western Europe, you can buy these as pets. They're apparently an interesting cross as a pet, sort of between a cat and a dog. They have a lot of dog-like abilities, but they're a bit more independent than most of your dogs during the day, so they'll kind of wander off and do stuff in your yard or whatnot during the day and then come back and, you know, hang out with you at night, you know, lay next to you. Or there was a picture there of one of them sitting on the table as someone was working, just plopped on top of the papers and stuff. So very interesting how this works. And you said, you know, selecting for a very specific behavior here leads to all kinds of other changes. All right. Okay. We've just got a few minutes left, so we'll just get a start here on habituation and sensitization. Now, we've been talking then about a series of these innate behaviors, these very genetically controlled and regulated behaviors. We're going to move into habituation and sensitization here, and these are what we call the simplest forms of learning. And they really are very, very simple. So we'll take a peek here. Habituation and sensitization are forms of learning that alter a reflex. So they alter the way a reflex response occurs. This is not due to the formation of new synaptic connections. There's no new neurons being produced. There's no new synaptic connections being produced. This is the nervous system just working with what it's already got. So these are generally very temporary effects that occur at existing synaptic points. All right? So, for example, with habituation, this might involve less neurotransmitter being released than normal. If less neurotransmitter is released, the next neuron is less likely to cross threshold and fire. And so, considering the reflex, we've got that reflex arc from sensory neuron to inner neuron to motor neuron. Well, if you've got habituation occurring there between, say, the synaptic connection from the sensory to the interneuron, if the sensory neuron is releasing less neurotransmitter, the interneuron may not cross threshold. If it doesn't cross threshold, then you may not get that reflexive response, the muscle contraction, which, say, retracts the limb. Okay? In sensitization, it could be just the opposite. An increase in neurotransmitter makes it much more likely that the next neuron will pass threshold. Bam, you get the response. So these are playing with, at least over short time frames, reflexes, altering the outcome there. Okay. So habituation is a decrease in a reflex response due to repeated presentations of the stimulus. Okay, so after you've presented the stimulus that is going to lead to a reflexive response, you do this a bunch of times, you get habituation if the reflexive response decreases or maybe even stops. Just a little note here, keep in mind, not everything that leads to a decrease in response is due to habituation. You get into things like complete neurotransmitter depletion. Okay, and it just has to build up. It takes a while for the neurons to make more neurotransmitter. So maybe other things going on. Muscle fatigue, right? Lactic acid buildup, all kinds of stuff could happen. So not everything that leads to a decrease in response is going to be due to habituation. Sensitization, really just the opposite here. It's an increase in response following the repeated presentations of a stimulus. Okay, so we're going to see a lot of stuff with rats and pigeons as we go through this course, so I thought I'd use banana slugs here instead. Wonderful banana slug. We don't have them here in Alberta, which is just a shame, but these are slugs that get to be like, you know, about yay big. Go out to the West Coast. Everyone's going to the West Coast for the summer vacation or whatnot, Vancouver Island, you know. Slugs. Yay. You make a wonderful banana slug cream pie. Just got to make sure that you get your egg beater going really fast. You don't want to miss eye stalks or something. Not really. I don't think anyone actually turns them into pie. Okay. So here's the deal. And I actually collected some data on this for teaching this segment a number of years back, actually a long time back. But slugs have eye stalks. Their eyes are out on little sort of tentacles. Okay. Quite delicate, all right? I mean, you know, if your eyes were out on little tentacles, something goes bip and cuts it off, you've just lost an eye. Our eyes are nicely protected in, you know, orbital ridges of bone, and very, very hard to damage there. Unless you're my friend Matt, you just happen to stick your finger in your eye, which he did a couple of weeks ago. Anyways, most people don't damage their eyes too easily. So here's the deal with banana slugs. If you lightly touch them on their back, yeah, you're going to get a little bit slimy, but it's for science, okay? So you lightly touch them. What they're going to do is they're going to be a little like, they pull their eye stalks back in. And then after a little bit of time, they sort of like, you know, put one out, look around, and go back. Okay. So what I did here is a trail going down to a beach, sat there and poked a slug for a little bit, you know, and recorded the time it would take for the eye stalks to fully re-extend back out. Okay, so there's another one. Different coloration patterns. Variation, right? Variation. Greens, yellows, oranges, black spots. Yeah. I'm sensing people aren't really into the slugs as much as I kind of hoped. So I should have done this with what, puppies or something instead? Okay. Okay, so here's some data, okay? The slug eye stalk re-extension time. So try one. Touch the slug, eye stalks come in. I'm touching the slug very lightly. It was barely touching its back. It took 23 seconds for the eyes to go all the way, eye stalks go all the way back out. Okay. And I gave it a minute, touched it again. Okay? So trial two. Oh, right. I'm going to plot this on a graph. Right. Because scientists like graphs. Okay. So here we go. Trial one. There we are. 23 seconds. Trial two. This time, only 12 seconds for the slug to re-extend its eye stalks. Trial three, 10 seconds. Trial four, 7 seconds. Five, 3 seconds. And six, 1 second. Now, I didn't have any little micro calipers, so I couldn't really record this. But after about the third trial, so in like trial four, it wasn't pulling the eye stalks all the way back in. It sort of like halfway and back. By trial six, it just did sort of like that. Barely moved the eyes. Okay, so look, think about this. If you're a slug and your eyes are kind of delicate, if something touches you or brushes you, you know what it is, it could be dangerous. Safety response. But you're a slug. You don't move very fast. What if it's just some grass that keeps blowing onto your back, right? If every time that piece of grass touches you, you hunk your eyes back in for 23 seconds, that's 23 seconds that you're not moving anywhere. You don't move very fast to begin with. You're not eating, right? You're losing a lot of time. And the grass is just going to keep tapping you on the back. Okay, so here's where habituation becomes very useful. Same thing happens over and over and over again. Nothing really bad happens to you. Boom. Okay, less neurotransmitter being released at the synapse that controls this reflexive response. Eventually, you just don't pay any attention. The eye stalks stay out. The slug keeps doing its thing. Okay? All right. So we are, unfortunately, out of time here today, so we'll finish this off next class. So we'll see you on Thursday.